So today we start a new sermon series called Recovering the Rest of Sabbath. And so we're going to be, for the next several weeks, really from now until Advent, revolving around this theme of Sabbath, learning about it, learning how to practice it more faithfully. So not only is it the beginning of a series because we had one end recently, but generally for the last, almost 10 years at this point, I've tried every fall season, so around September-ish, to begin a new series that has maybe a little extra focus and intentionality on spiritual formation. And this is one of those series, and it's reflected in the fact that not only the topic of learning how to practice Sabbath well, but in the bulletin, if you grabbed one on your way in, you have it in your hands. If you don't have one, you can grab one on your way out. There's always extra content in there that launches from the sermon, the reflection questions, some additional devotional material, and there's spiritual practices. So for this series, those practices will actually center around these concepts of Sabbath that we are learning about. It's usually that spot has stuff from Richard Foster and Celebration of Discipline. So for this series, it's specifically going to focus on these themes of Sabbath. And several of the ideas and quotes I'm going to be using I found in a book by Mark Buchanan called The Rest of God. It is a book that was written in 2007, which you might think, wow, that's an old book. But don't forget, we just finished a series where I used a book that's 60 years old. So I am creeping ever so slowly to the present day. But this book's been sitting on my shelf actually for a long time, and I've been thinking, I really want to read through that. I know it'll be good for me. I wonder if it'll be good to share with everyone, and indeed, it's fantastic. I'm barely going to scratch the surface of half of the things that he talks about, so if you're more interested in the book, I can give you the title. You can check out the cover today. I can show you the copy that I have here, Mark Buchanan, The Rest of God. And I knew I was only a few pages into this book when I realized that I would be warmly welcomed into it. I was just reading the opening of the preface. You know the part of the book you usually skip because it's relatively dull and you're not all that interested and you want to get to page one. So I'm reading the first few paragraphs of the preface, and I realize the author is speaking to me because he is writing about something that I am very well familiar with, and that is the daily habits of domesticated felines. And that's not just any cat. That is my cat. Yeah. So he uses in the opening pages, and I just thought it was fantastic, a metaphor, an illustration that he saw in his own life. And he's admittedly a dog person. He tells that whole story. But he talks about seeing cats laying in these slivers of light that come through the windows, especially during the cold months, and how cats would find themselves plopping down, lounging, and then full out stretching in that patch of sunlight on a cold, especially winter's day. And I read those words, and I just thought, yes, I can connect with all of these things. It actually reminded me, there's an old Garfield comic. You might not be able to see the words, but I can share it with you. Garfield says, oh, I'll never make it across that sunbeam awake. But then he says, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And he makes a leap and, of course, falls flat on his face and falls asleep. And then his buddy John comes up. Come on, Garfield, let's go for a walk. And as you can see, he barely makes it into the field of sunshine himself and falls asleep next to his beloved cat. And for those of you who are not cat fans, first of all, I'm sorry about your life. But second of all, if you like dogs better, I found a picture that includes cats and dogs just for you. So here's one of cats and dogs all lined up, taking advantage of the same patch of sunshine. And somebody in the comments for the picture, I thought it was hilarious. They said, not only is this a fun example of them all crowding into the same sliver of sunshine, but it's a perfect example of how cats and dogs are so different. The three cats are basically completely ignoring the human being in the picture and focusing only on cleaning themselves, whereas the two dogs are looking up at the camera going, this is good, but if you want to go do stuff, we can do stuff. I love doing stuff. Doing stuff with you is my favorite thing. So whether it's cats or dogs, he uses this metaphor of becoming still in this patch of sunlight. He puts it this way. Those cats spread out in warm patches of sunlight seem to be experiencing utter contentment in their stillness. The impression I got was that they were emptying themselves and filling themselves all at once. And when I think of Sabbath, that image comes to mind. Sabbath is an invitation at one and the same time to empty yourself and fill yourself. And there is a lot of deep truth in that. And that's part of what we're going to be unpacking in the coming weeks, how Sabbath is an invitation to both empty yourself, but also refill yourself. Let me tell you, though, what this series will not be. It is not an attempted list of developing do's and don'ts for Sabbath keeping. If you're coming into it thinking, excellent, I can finally get a new checklist so I can do Sabbath right, you're going to be really disappointed. That's not what this is going to be about. That kind of strategy gets bound up in the corkscrew of legalism almost immediately. It's the kind of end game that Jesus spent a lot of time dissecting during his ministry when he taught about Sabbath and acted on Sabbath. And we'll be looking at some of those episodes from the Gospels over this time together. Now, yes, Sabbath observance is important. Choosing a day, or even if you're super busy, a half day among seven to feast or rest or worship or play is a gift from God that for many of us, if we're honest, remains unopened. God gives us that gift and we walk away either because we are too busy to open it or we would feel too guilty stopping to open it. Maybe some of both of those things or maybe others. But just like the rest of the Ten Commandments, of which the command to Sabbath is one of those, Sabbath is about much more than just a cold observance. Just like the other commandments. I might put it this way. Sabbath is about so much more than cold observance. It's about cultivating and forming an attitude, an orientation, a perspective that encompasses far more than a legalistic halt of visible activity. Because that's what Sabbath can become in the end if it's a checklist. It's just a cold, legalistic halt of visible physical activity. But just like the other commandments, it's so much more than that. The command to do not murder is not just about don't shed blood. It's about why shouldn't I murder? Because we should look differently at the people that we share our lives with. We should see they're made in the image of Godness and therefore love them, serve them. Right? The command to covet is not just about trying to maintain an arbitrary line of our jealousy or lust for things. It's about learning how those things interact with our lives more deeply. Sabbath is the same way. It's not about a cold mathematical figuring out exactly the do's and the don'ts. Buchanan puts it in the book this way: Sabbath imparts the rest of God, actual physical, mental, spiritual rest, but also the rest of God, the things of God's nature and presence we miss in our busyness. And that's sort of the play on words of this whole sermon series. We're going to be recovering the rest of God, meaning the actual act of resting and Sabbathing, but bigger than that, the rest of God. Because when we Sabbath, at least I know this is true for me, it's usually done in fragmentation, in bits and pieces. And when we do it in fragmentation, there are bits and pieces of what God has for us that we don't experience or know. And so the attempt is to experience the rest of God in that way, the fragments, the bits that we may have been missing out on the entire time. So let's start by reading through a psalm that we've already referenced, one of the themes of this psalm, multiple times in the worship that we've already shared together, Psalm 46, verses 1 through 11. God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, and the mountains quake with their surging. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her, and she will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in uproar, kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice, and the earth melts. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come and see what the Lord has done, the desolations he has brought upon the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. He says, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress." Most of the time in life, if you want knowledge, you have to pursue that knowledge. You have to go after it. And for the vast majority of human history, That meant you need to seek out someone who knows the thing that you don't yet know and speak with that person in order to learn directly from him or from her. Now, within the last little bit of human history, things have changed. We can pursue knowledge through other avenues. A few generations ago, that meant you had to go to the local library and consult the card catalog. Anybody remember the card catalog? I tried to describe that to my children. Makes zero sense to them. Zero sense that there would be a thing called a card catalog at the local library. But you could consult the card catalog. You could dust off these really large books called encyclopedias to pursue knowledge. You could even, if you were really desperate and going really deep, you could get out the microfiche machine. Anybody remember that nonsense? Wow, yeah. Maybe some of you still use that. I shouldn't call it nonsense. But listen, nowadays, if you want to pursue knowledge, way easier. Two clicks or taps in Google and you're there. You maybe go to Wikipedia specifically and you can find it. Or if you're looking for a how-to, you go to this magical thing called YouTube and you can find out how to do almost anything that you want to do almost immediately. You still have to pursue the knowledge that you seek. But what this psalm teaches us, and this is key for Sabbathing, is that there is some kind of knowing, a deeper kind of knowing that cannot be pursued. It can only be received. And in order to be received, there's one qualification. You have to be still. Because the psalm says, be still and what? And know. There is some knowledge that can't be caught by pursuit. It can only be received through stillness. And to do so is in stark contrast to the world around us. I love in that psalm, in Psalm 46, it talks about being still in the midst of things like roaring, foaming, quaking, surging, falling apart. And I want to tell you, friends, if you're not aware of this or just need reminded, our world is roaring, foaming, breaking apart with busyness everywhere, constantly, and beckoning for us to join in the madness. And when you choose to Sabbath, when you choose to participate and doing Sabbath and letting that Sabbath seep into every single day of your life, you'll be operating in stark contrast with the world around us that is roaring and foaming with busyness. A world in which we have whiplash calls to attention from everywhere and everything. And being still in that world is really, really hard. It will almost feel like, if you are brave enough to entertain it, it will feel like what I imagine it feels like to walk up the down escalator. I've never done that because I don't want to be that guy, although it looks like it'd be a fun challenge. But imagine walking up the down escalator. That is trying to live with this sense of stillness in the world that is foaming and roaring with busyness. You will be pretty constantly fighting against a momentum that is really, really strong. But I want to promise you, it is worth it. It is worth it to get that knowledge of who God is and who we are that doesn't come any other way. So we're going to be talking a lot about rest and Sabbath and all that that means. But before we get to that, the one thing I want to talk about today is work. And you're probably thinking, Pastor, you don't get this. You don't talk about work in a series of sermons about Sabbath. Actually, I would argue, and I will argue, that we really need to talk about that before we get to the other stuff. So let's look at just one verse in Genesis chapter 2 to remind us of who we are as human beings. The Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to do what? To work it and to take care of it. Work was part of God's very good creation before the fall. You don't get the fall and then work. You get work and then the fall. It is part of God's good, very good creation. It is a divinely crafted and gracefully given gift to humankind. We are wired for work in the best possible way. But that then begs the question, so why do so many of us hate our jobs? And you laugh because you know it's true. There's a study done by a guy in 1974, an oral historian with one of the coolest names I've ever read, Studs Terkel. That's an awesome name. Studs Terkel wrote a book, 1974. The title was Work, but the subtitle is even better. People talk about what they do all day and how they feel about what they do. He did tons of interviews with people all across the spectrum of what people are doing for work in their world, and this is what he found out. Most people live somewhere between a grudging acceptance of their job and an active dislike of it. And you might try and make the argument, but yeah, things are a lot different and better now than they were in 1974. I can't speak to that. I wasn't there yet. But I look around at my world and I go, I don't think it's a lot different. I don't think it's a lot different. So why? If work is this very good God-given gift of grace, why do so many people feel like Studs here recorded them feeling? You only have to flip one more chapter past the fall to find out. Genesis 3. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. You will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. Did you notice how many hard words there are? And not hard to pronounce, but like challenging words. I mean, just look at that passage again. Cursed, painful, toil, thorns, thistles, the sweat of your brow. Those are not easy words or terms. Work in Genesis 2 became toil in Genesis chapter 3. So then how do we endure this thing that was a good gift given from God's grace and becomes toil from work? How do we get through it? How do we survive it? How do we endure it? Well, the comic character Dilbert has this suggestion. He says, eat one live toad the first thing in the morning and nothing worse will happen to you the rest of the day. I have not field tested this theory. If you have, stay away from me. I don't think I want to talk to you anymore. But in theory, that's probably right. And if you know Dilbert, he's this classic office worker environment type thing. How do we endure, survive, and attempt to thrive in our world of work if, like Studs claims, most of us don't actually want to be in it to begin with? Well, I would argue that there are two things that we most likely do in order to try and survive and endure. And they are fleeing and dreaming. We flee and we dream. Let's talk about fleeing first. We run away. We run away from work, especially when work becomes toil. We just try and get away from it, get out of it, get it behind us, whatever it takes. The other option, though, is to dream about a post-work world for yourself. To dream and think about, okay, I'm in the toil now, but someday I will be beyond it. And I have to say this, small doses of these things are not wrong, bad, or problematic. I mean, we all need to flee, to step aside. Let's say this. There's a difference between stepping aside and running away. Stepping aside is good and healthy. And dreaming about a post-work, a post-toil life, that's fine. It's great. Make plans, have dreams. But I think what happens is we get stuck in these things too often and for too long. We attempt to flee or we attempt to dream our way out of it. And if we flee, then we miss the goodness of work that has been wired into us. And if we dream, we miss the opportunities for what God has for us right now because we're way too busy thinking about what's to come. Mark Buchanan says, without a rich theology of labor, we will have an impoverished theology of rest. We have to understand work first in order to understand rest well. And he gives one example that I think is a wonderful example to pull from as far as a passage of scripture that elevates vocation. That's what we're talking about today, vocation elevation. And it's from Luke chapter 5. Oh, I forgot to say, God's solution is rest. Sometimes I get too far ahead of myself. Our solutions are to flee or to dream. God gives us this gift of Sabbath. A gift, again, that much of the time remains unopened, and yet his solution isn't to sponsor our fleeing or our dreaming as much as it is to give us the gift of rest in the midst of the work. So, Luke 5. One day as Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, the people were crowding around him and listening to the word of God. And he saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little from shore. Then he sat down and taught the people from the boat. When he'd finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water. Let down the nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything. But because you say so, I will let down the nets." And when they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and they filled both boats so full that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord, I am a sinful man." For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. And Jesus says to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will fish for people." So they pulled their boats up on the shore and left everything and followed him. When you hear the phrase, doing the Lord's work, what comes to mind? If someone says to you or you hear somebody say, "Oh, well, we need to get on with doing the Lord's work," what comes into your brain? Is it preaching or evangelism or assisting the poor and the marginalized or maybe filling a role within the leadership structure of your local congregation? What does it mean to do the Lord's work? Because I would argue, Buchanan does in the book, and I agree, that this story on the surface sort of gives that meaning, that the Lord's work is something that you are called away and called into. Because see, Peter, James, and John were working in the fishing industry. They were probably small business owners because they had their own boats. And Jesus called them, it seems on the surface, to something better, something more important. But I think there's an argument, and a really good one, that actually that's exactly the upside down and maybe backwards way to read what is happening here. Because what I think Jesus actually does is elevates our day-to-day work, vocation, and toil. What seems mundane can be a vocation. Let's recognize how their day, these fishermen, went from work to toil. Because we read in verse 2 that they are doing what? They are washing their nets. And the process of washing your net is not only rinsing it, but also mending it, because it's assumed that it might catch on something here or there, and you might have a weak spot or an actual hole. So they're washing and mending their nets. We find out in verse 5, how much did they catch even though they were fishing all night? Big fat zero. See, work becomes toil at the end of a day in which your nets are both empty and broken. Mama said there'll be days like this. Be days like this, Mama said. I mean, work is work, and work is sometimes toil, but at the end of a day, when your nets are empty and needing mended, that is not a good day. That is a day where work easily becomes toil. And so it's at this point, if Jesus really wanted to make a statement about the value of the Lord's work in comparison with other kinds of work and vocation, he likely would not have encouraged Peter, "Hey, let's go out into the deep water and let's try this fish-catching thing all over again." No. Instead, he would have taken this perfect opportunity to expose the toil of this trade compared to the high and holy calling of fishing for people. He would have said, "Gentlemen, I see you mending these nets, catching nothing all night. Let me show you something that's beyond this everyday menial task." But is that what Jesus does? No. Instead, he says, "Let's try again. Let's go out into the deeper water." And even though Peter is a very experienced fisherman, and he could have easily said, "Did you hear me, right? Like, we tried this once during the best time for fishing and we caught nothing." But they go out, and of course, you read the rest of the story. They catch this huge catch of fish. Jesus redeems the toil. Jesus elevates the labor. Jesus brings goodness into the work, and not just some, a lot, like a net-threatening catch of fish that is just about sinking two boats because there's so much. When we realize the presence of Christ in the midst of our vocation, abundance is possible where there only existed emptiness beforehand. We can go from mending empty nets to seeing the abundance that God has for us, even in the middle of vocation, work, even toil. There's a book called Practicing the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence, a 17th century follower of Jesus who worked in a monastery doing some basically day labor stuff for them, and he attempted to practice the presence of God moment by moment. And this is one of the things he said about work. He said, in his business in the kitchen, to which he had naturally a great aversion. Anybody been there before? A great aversion to the work in the kitchen? No? Just me? Okay, great. Having accustomed himself to do everything there for the love of God and with prayer upon all occasions for his grace to do his work well, he found everything easy during the 15 years that he had been employed there. There's an elevation of vocation. There's goodness in the work and in the labor. And if you read the story that we just read, you realize that Jesus made it harder for these guys to leave their vocation, their work of fishing. Because in this moment, they are surrounded by evidence of what can be the goodness of their work. There are these flip-flapping fish all around them. They're probably still pumped with adrenaline of the push and the pull of trying to maneuver nets and fish and everything into boats. This is not an easy time to walk away from the work and the vocation of being a fisherman. I mean, think of this. When Peter kneels down and falls at the feet of Jesus, he's literally surrounded by the evidence of the goodness that can come from the work that he has been called to do. Work that could be very, very good. And so the story isn't about the elevation of some vocations over others. The story is, in part, at least, about calling. Yes, it's about Jesus calling these men to be fishers of men, because that became their calling. After a season of being fishermen, they became fishers of men. But that doesn't mean that being fishermen is this lowly thing that needs to be walked away from by all people. It also gets elevated to a sense of doing good work. Which reminds me, I want to finish with one last quote from Martin Luther. He talks about this concept, and I love this quote. He says, "The maid who sweeps her kitchen is doing the will of God just as much as the monk who prays. Not because she may sing a Christian hymn as she sweeps, but because God loves clean floors. The Christian shoemaker does his Christian duty not by putting little crosses on the shoes, but by making good shoes, because God is interested in good craftsmanship. Because there is good in the work that we've been called to do. As human beings, we are wired for it." And so I wanted to take this time before we jump into the deep end on Sabbathing. We need to have a healthy, robust theology of what work is, how we are called to it, where it fits into our lives in order to then start learning about how to Sabbath well from the work that we're called to do. So a few things to think about, reflect on prayerfully as we finish up our time studying Scripture together. Here's the first one. How well do you rest? How effective are you at stopping? Are you ready and willing to examine the place and priority of Sabbath in your life? Because that's what we'll be doing in the coming weeks together. Secondly, what are some examples of the roaring and surging of busyness in your life in particular, and where did those things come from? Third, when confronted with your day-to-day tasks and toil, do you have a tendency to flee or dream too much or too often? And then lastly, ask God to help you see the good in your, and I mistyped it, that should say vocation and not vacation. Although somebody said earlier in the first service, like, what did you mean? And I'm like, Lord, what are you trying to teach me? Do I need a vacation from my vocation? But ask God to help you see the good in your vocation, inviting the Holy Spirit to be revealed through your work and maybe even your toil. So I'm going to flip through those once again, and whatever grabs your heart, whatever you want to focus on in this moment of silence as we stop our voices so the Spirit can speak to each one of us, and then I will close that time of reflection in just a moment with a word of prayer.